sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The S&P posts back-to-back weekly declines. Barron's gets desperate. And Japan's stocks are in a correction. All this and much more on episode number 316 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. Andrew Horowitz here. And it is the beginning of June already. Episode number 316 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And however you found us, whether it's through iTunes, right through the disciplinedinvestor.com, through a friend, do me a favor, send out the love outside. You know, give them a link over to the iTunes directory. Give somebody a link to, hey, this is a cool podcast, or, you know, you may learn something. Let's spread the love a little bit and see if we can kind of continue to expand the audience and learning process, as well as the great information that we do share here each and every week. I have lots to talk about because it has been a very big week. Yes, indeed. We saw back-to-back declines for the S&P 500, actually all the major indices, and around the world, things weren't much better. We saw that there was a major hiccup in the Japanese markets as the yen started to come down because we saw yields on the JGBs, which we've talked about a lot. As a matter of fact, I talked about over the last several weeks utilizing an ETF to short the Japanese government bonds, where they're rates went from somewhere around 50, 60 basis points up to about 1% recently. Rates around the world have been rising as well. And it's a question of whether or not, on the one hand, we're seeing that economies are getting better, or on the other hand, there is a revolt going on and you have the bond vigilantes going out and saying, you know what, your debt is too high and we're not going to pay for it. Now, one of the things that's happening is a little bit of a reverse in the markets. It's really kind of fascinating. Because usually what the pundits have been talking about over the last 6 or 7 months, and maybe even a year, is that once bond rates start to get so low that there is going to be nowhere else for them to go, we're going to see this massive move from bonds, allowing rates to rise, into stocks in a gigantic, epic rotation. Wow. Interesting. What we're seeing is just the opposite. As rates go higher, we're seeing certain areas of the market, like the utilities and interest-sensitive areas, REITs, get hammered. And we're not seeing much support for the other areas as well. So what we're finding is that conventional wisdom is really not playing out as well as you think it should. As a matter of fact, that's been a lot of the occurrence recently, where you see that things look like they should be going this way. In fact, they start moving exactly the opposite way. So we're going to talk about that. As a matter of fact, we have a great guest on today. His name is Mark Hanna. He is the manager of the Paladin Fund, Long Short Fund, and we're going to talk with him about some of this. We go back and forth with emails and kind of share a good amount of information in terms of research here and there, and I thought I would bring him on to talk with us as well today. But let me discuss some of the things that are really on the forefront and some of the economics we need to know about. This is going to be a very important week. But, you know, you did see that the Japanese stocks, we had a 7% down day for the Nikkei. We had a 3% down day, a 5% down day. And overall, it is in correction territory, which is down more than 10% from the top. Now, of course, you have many of the finance ministers and the various talking heads over there saying that, hey, it's just natural process of this whole monetary move and change in the monetary environment, blah, 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 blah. The problem is they are buying bonds at a record clip and increased their purchases to 8 times per month, and they still can't keep the rates down. This is a big issue. I want you to watch that very carefully because the correlation right now of the yen to other assets is very high. Remember that the short yen trade was a very, very crowded trade, whereas the green light was given because not only was the G20, G7, and the Japanese government behind the idea that, hey, a weakening yen is good, but investors piled on dramatically. Hedge funds, individuals, mutual funds, governments even. And when it starts to unwind, it gets a little bit ugly. We're tapping about the 100.25 level when it was about 103.5 recently. And that's a big move in about a week and a half for a currency. And what we're seeing is also gold breaking down. We're seeing oil breaking down, stocks breaking down. A lot of this, as I had told you, was going to happen if the yen starts changing direction. Again, we are also long the yen. We were short the Japanese Nikkei. What a great return from the Nikkei last week. Hopefully you were short that position because it really played out very nicely. It was tough to find out where the top would go to, and it was tough to figure out if you wanted to be long, but the short side of things looked like it was very clear. We reduced down that position on Friday, seeing that it was a very, very quick move, and maybe there's going to be some room for a little bit of a jump, so just consider that. The other things I want to talk about real quickly is Barron's. Barron's has a weekly magazine, as you know, and I really don't read it that much. I read the cover. I read the highlights from a couple different sources that come through. I don't buy the magazine, nor do I subscribe to it. But I thought it was really interesting that the cover was all about legalization of marijuana, taking the whole idea that, hey, wouldn't it be great for this $30 billion plus industry to legalize it, tax it, regulate it, and it would be a great benefit for the U.S. And but you know what? This is not the first time I've seen these National Enquirer type of headlines and front page stories on Barron's. And you have to wonder just how much they're bleeding membership and subscriptions due to, you know, the ability to get the same kind of information around the web. And I just wonder if they're trying to really beef up their headlines to do a great look factor because they really need to be bring in the subscriptions and subscribers much in a greater clip than they have in the past. Because, you know, when markets start moving in a direction and they move up in particular, and people get complacent. You don't want to – who cares about reading the information? I was out to dinner with some friends the other night. They're like, oh, how's the investing going? Yeah, I was thinking about putting more money in because the market just goes up and up and up. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, how many other people are thinking that's the only way that markets go? Markets can go down. And by the way, let's talk about that. I am thinking, I want you to remember this, I am thinking that it is possible to do a reverse Tepper concept. David Tepper came out a few years ago and said that no matter what happens, if the economy gets worse, the Fed will step in. If the economy gets better, the markets go up. Either way is a great place to be. I wonder if we're going to have, I guess we'll call it a repet moment. That's Tepper in reverse with the jobs number that is coming this Friday. Because on Friday, we have the number that is all important to investors, and let's think about what can happen. If, in fact, we see that the jobs numbers are, in fact, better than expected, we may have a sell-off because there is concern that the Fed may actually start tapering or pulling back in their bond purchases and stimulus, and that's what has been resonating with many investors recently. On the other hand, let's say that we have a situation where a much worse jobs number comes out. Now, that's never good, by the way. Particularly the way you want to play that is while it may be good from a stimulus standpoint, and you may see markets really perk up, by the end of the day, usually what will happen is they'll sell off because they realize that over the weekend, the markets open in China and Thailand and Asia, and they're going to see a number that they're not happy about and sell off, and oftentimes that reverberates around the world. So I wonder if, unless we get the number to be spot on, right on about 165,000 new hires approximately, I guess we're up to about 175,000 right now, and an unemployment rate of 7.5, if we're going to see anything more than the potential for a downside in either circumstance. I'm serious about this. We've had the opposite happen for a long time. But now, in the mindset of investors, if they're thinking that the Fed is looking for places to start pulling back, and if we get a very strong number, that's a very big concern for, I think, the markets in terms of the stimulus. If it's super strong, you know, if we see like, 250,000 or 260,000, that may pull us out of those doldrums and not worry about it because we realize that the economy is strong and the hiring is going on, you know, pretty significantly. So just consider those couple of things in the big mix of what's going to happen this week. I want to talk about the rest of these and a couple of other things in particular about the market conditions. But I want to get to our guest because I know that when we get together and talk, we usually talk about a lot of things. So let's get right to this topic before we go any further. So let's talk to Mark Hanna. And he is we call him a trader. He's a mutual fund manager of the Paladin Long Short Fund, symbol PALFX, and writes some great commentary on the web, on a website that is marketmontage.com. And Mark, you and I, we talk a lot, right? We talk all the time about what's going on with the markets. We are a little bit skeptical and we have been, and maybe not exactly right of some of the conditions in the market. But what are you kind of seeing these days?
Well, I'd say we've been incorrectly skeptical if price is the only thing that matters, right? We have to admit that. It's been an amazing year. I'd say since November, mid-November bottom, 2012. This has been literally a straight-up, almost 45-degree angle move. There's only been 3%-ish type of corrections late February, mid-April, and the previous week and a half as we sit here. That's rare. There's only been 3 years, I believe, in the past 20 where there's not even been a 5% correction by this point of the year. So we're in, I would say uncharted territory, but rare error. It's interesting. It's very interesting. And this we've seen QE1, QE2 markets, and those were markets that there was an end date. And obviously, as you know, your listeners know, we're in QE infinity. So there's a doubt that the market just goes straight up without correcting or without coming in 5%, which is very, very typical, 10%, which typically happens once a year. Or on any news whatsoever, but it's just been straight up until, and the only thing that seems to worry the market at this point is taking away QE.
You know, you think of the market as, well, first of all, I put up a post a couple days ago and I called the market the punch clown. You remember those punch clowns where you'd fill the bottom up with sand, blow it up, and you punch it and you keep punching it and it just keeps coming back? And it's kind of like what the markets are like. But I think what's interesting is the investor sentiment. Whereas
it's doubtful. It's a lot of people feel doubtful about it.
Yeah, but they're doubtful.
Not the only one.
They're doubtful, but investor sentiment about not worrying about things as much in terms of those that are bullish. You know, it's like, are they immune to some of the news that's out there and the obvious things that are going on? Is it that there's short-term memory, or is it like a cockroach that you keep on spraying with a particular insecticide, and after a while they just become, kind of immune to that?
An actual story, by the way. You know that, right?
No, what's that? What story?
That's actually happening. I wrote a story about that 2 or 3 days ago.
You did?
I didn't. Yeah, actually true. They're mutating. As of everything, there's things evolve to their environment, and maybe that's what investors are doing. Used to be, in a way, it's good because for years now, it's really since 2007, we've been what I would call a macro environment where it really didn't matter what you picked, long or short. It just mattered that you were either in or out at the right time. So, which is a frustrating thing to do because that's literally, a lot of your homework is kind of thrown out the door. It's either, a European official said this positively summer 2010 or September, summer 2011 or even 12, or vice versa, or a Finnish guy said this, a German guy said this, or the Bernanke said this, or Geithner said this, and the market would, dump 3% that day or rise 2%. Almost all of it overnight, a lot of it overnight in aftermarkets, so it's impossible even to get to adjust yourself to what they're saying. So we're getting away from that to some degree this year, which is a positive. But, it's a David Tepper belief ideology, which we've talked about in the past, many times. Literally, he said, we're doing quantitative easing, and his most recent appearance, I think, about 2 or 3 weeks ago on CNBC was, now tapering is good for the market, because otherwise, if they don't taper, we're going to be going to 1999, second half to 1999, which is basically, for those who don't follow markets that closely, a parabolic move. So we're even now in an environment where QE is good for us and less QE is good for us. So that's kind of the ideology a lot of people are in right now. You know, forget all news. The market goes up and, you know, we can be doubtful. It's almost in many ways, the more you think about the market, it's been a penalty. You know, if you're just kind of simplistic about it and, you know, again, the David Tepper mindset that either the economy is going to get better and that's good for markets, or the Fed's going to intervene and that's good for markets. So there's really no bad for market situation.
You know, do you know the difference between tapering and tampering?
I think I read on your Twitter feed one letter.
That's all it is. Tapering and tampering.
Can I address the tapering comment first of all? Because I think it's very incorrect, and people have been reading kind of the you know, there's a gentleman named John Hilson Rath at the Wall Street Journal, which I called many years the Fed whisperer, and you know, he's widely acknowledged to kind of be a place to leak. And, well, you know, basically the Fed doesn't want to surprise markets. It wants them to know everything ahead of time and adjust, et cetera, which is fine. It's almost too transparent in my viewpoint at this point, because every little, you know, they change a phrase or change a comma in their statement or a speech, and, you know, again, the market drops, goes up and down based off that. But tapering is an incorrect way to think about what's happening. And I'm the only one saying this right now, but really we should be using the term plateauing. And what does that mean? Where the Fed has made very, very clear they're not going to be taking away QE anytime soon. Now, they have said in their last FOMC minutes, about three or four weeks ago, that they added a phrase that they could either increase or decrease purchases. Now what the market reacted to that was, oh my God, they added the term increase, whereas before it was just assumed that we're at $85 billion and the only way is down. So that actually kicked off this last leg of this rally. Or it put it into another, you know, another gear, let's say, because not only could the Fed be staying where they are, there is a potential they could be going up to a higher number. Now, here's the reality, and what I think Bernanke kind of tried to temper that with, you know, a week ago Wednesday, there was, you know, there's been a lot of sea changes under the surface. You know, the indexes have kind of stayed up. You know, they've corrected some. We've had a 3% correction, but there's been a lot of changes under the surface in terms of yield versus non-yield stocks. We can talk about that a little bit later. But what he's trying to prepare the market is that they're going to be going from one plateau to another. They're not going to be tapering. To me, is we're going to go from 85 to 75 or 85 to 70, then we're going to go to 60, and then we're going to 50, and we're going to go 20, and then we're going to go away. And what people need to think about is the QE is a new Fed funds rate, is the way I describe it. Before they used to go from 2 to 1, or you know, they usually go in quarter increments, 2 to 1.75 to 1.5 to 1.25. So now people think QE is going to go again, you know, in 10 or 15 or 20 increments down and down until it gets back to zero. What both Dudley has said, which is the vice president of New York Fed, what Hilson Rath is leaking, what Bernanke is hinting, is they're going to do a plateau system. And what a plateau is basically a flat, you know, I call that because it's a flat level and, you know, of elevation, and then you can go up or down from that level to another plateau. So right now we're at 85. Let's use $15 billion as an increment. They could go next meeting or three meetings from now and say, we're going to drop it to 70, or we can increase it to 100. And then we're just going to keep it there for a while, and we're going to see what the economy does. So 85 now, maybe next January it's going to be 60 or 40 or 70. But it's not. From there, if the economy weakens, they can go right back up to 85, or they go to 100.
You know, it's funny because a couple
of
things.
That's tapering.
Yeah, it's interesting. First of all, you know, Hilson Rath would obviously debate you on the fact that he is the Fed whisperer or the mouthpiece of the Fed in the paper.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it's interesting that the idea that purchasing of bonds by the Fed will actually stimulate the economy. If you really back that out for a second and think about that, it's ridiculous.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you on 2 points, only two points. Only interest rate sensitive markets, like especially. Well, I'll say one, especially is housing. I think it's helped housing.
Yeah, no question about that. No, I agree with you on there. Of course.
And
yes.
Then autos at the margin, because you know if you're going to buy a $25,000 car, you're either you know if the interest rate is 3.9% or 4.9%. You know, you're generally going to be able to buy it one way or the other. Maybe you can buy a little bit more car, or you can buy a car every 3.5 years as opposed to 5 years or something. So there's some change there. But I think housing is the one place it's made a change. But their mandate is employment. So in the housing market, yeah, it's important to employment. But it's in the big picture, you know, it's, again, at the margin. You're changing $300,000 to $400,000 jobs over the course of a couple of years. And, you know, if you do the price per job, you know, it takes $3 trillion of balance sheet expansion to gain one million extra jobs. Right. Those are expensive jobs.
Yeah, I want that job. I want the pay that comes with that. But here's a couple of things. Now, when you look at what's gone on, not only here, and I think that we have talked about on this show, there's somewhere about, since 2008, about 515 rate cuts around the world that have happened.
Amazing. Yeah,
which
amazing.
Is remarkable, which also, what totally gets me a little bit questioning things is, we're still seeing rate cuts these days, very few increases. There have been a few around the world. We saw some through the emerging markets as they had in some inflationary pressures.
Brazil.
But generally speaking, there's been no rate increases, and it's just been a continual move lower. Now, obviously, in the U.S., we don't have the ability to really move any lower. Let's not even talk about negative rates like there's some hinting going on in Europe about, which is totally preposterous, by the way. I was thinking, how great would it be if I was to buy a house and get a full mortgage on as much as I can and be paid 1% to own that house? How many houses would be sold at that point, right? But
yeah, exactly. But don't give them ideas.
Right.
Don't give them ideas. is this being played in the D.C. area?
We're keeping this offline. But here's what's really fascinating. Look at now what's gone on with Japan over the years. We know this. Let's kind of say that. Not everybody knows I've been – actually, I got some listener email today that said they're really upset with me, how negative I've been on Japan. Let me just tell you a couple of things. First of all, Asia is my favorite place in the world. All of Asia, okay?
Yeah, you were just right there, weren't you?
Many times. Yeah. Secondly, I love Japan. I do not like the economics of Japan, and I'm not saying this politically or not. I'm just telling you the economics of Japan, demographic-wise, the whole potential for it is a real problem.
The resources are there. The United States is very blessed because not only do we have decent demographics, we are blessed in resources here. And a lot of people don't understand Japan is a small island, 180 million people, and you know they have to import basically or nuclear react all their energy, all those other things. So there's a lot of disadvantages there.
So now, but here's the thing. So they go ahead and do incredible amounts of stimulus through bond buying and unlimited and, you know, trying to not – they're not really trying to drop the yen. But if it happens because of this, it's okay. And this is becoming a problem because since the day they announced this – now, it was the kind of a sell the news situation – when they talked about it ad nauseum since November, which coincides very well to the discussion you just had about where the market rally started.
Right.
What happened was when they finally announced it, they saw a dramatic change in the not only the yen, but also in their bonds. What was happening was that even though they were coming in and buying extraordinary amounts of their bonds, they could no longer keep a lid on the rates. Because when the economy moves, or if they're intentionally trying to force people out of assets within Japan that are not equity assets, let's say, what happens is that bonds are going to be sold. And even with the full power and backing of an unlimited bond buying program, where they had to step in 8 times this month alone
to try to
and they saw and several halts on the futures markets because
that's the one scary part. Yeah, I mean, let's put it in perspective. I think their rates were 0.5%, and they're up to like 1%.
That's enormous, though. That's enormous.
It's enormous. Yeah, it's a doubling, and a lot of this stuff is not just direction; it's time. I mean, these moves are happening, you know, incredibly. And the currency move. I think the currency is down over 15% in short amount of time. So people who are stock investors, you understand that. Look, you know, you can be in Tesla, 15% is a day or 4 hours in that stock, but when a currency moves like that. You know, or a bond market moves that fast. I think directionally they're getting what they want. They don't want it to go so fast. And, you know, there's only so much, you know, like you're saying, you have a power of the unlimited purse with a central bank, and they have even raised concerns. You know, they're trying not to raise too many, but their finance minister kind of has tried to jawbone it down. So once you kind of let the genie out of the bottle, it's out there, but the market is bigger than even the central banks at a point, eventually at some point. It is. So that's what's happening up there. So I do think they want, you know, so here's the question. When they're going, you know, and for people who don't know, again, they're doing 2.5 times relative to their economy what Bernanke is doing and the Fed is doing They're doing about $80 billion a month, but their economy is one-third the size of the United States.
Mark, you have to mention, though, that they've also been doing QE style of stimulus for the last 15 years.
Yeah, but we're in a whole new era now. Now, they did things that back then were considered, wow, that's big, but, you know, Ben Bernanke has made it, you know, pretty much everything anybody has done, you know, laughable. You think about what Alan Greenspan did in 98 to react, you know, for viewer listeners who didn't follow the market back then. There was a hedge fund that blew up full of geniuses.
Yeah, long-term capital management. Yeah, yeah.
In 98, reacting to a currency crisis, actually, that started in Thailand, of all places, in 97, and then went to Russia. So these are a bunch of PhDs, you know, they were geniuses, and they're, you know, and the size, if you look back and read about the size we're talking about, is so small compared to things nowadays. That really was when Moral Hazard was born. And what he did for, to react in latter 98, and then in 1999 to prepare for Y2K, when everybody thought every computer would stop because of the, you know, changing from 1999 to 0000 or 2000, and nobody knew what was going to happen that day. You know, they flooded the system with money, but what we're doing now is, you know, we have no idea. This is just a grand experiment, and it's global. You know, that was one central bank, and it made the stock market go crazy, and then it crashed in March 2000. And Greenspan was considered a genius at the time, and, you know, and then now his history is considered very checkered, let's put it that way. I think Bernanke now is considered a genius in his time by many, not us, maybe me and you, and some other circles. Because we like to look at the other side of the slope. We're not just looking at the, the stock price. That's the only thing that matters in our lives. And I think he's gonna have a lot more of a checker viewpoint 7 or 8 years from now when we get to the other side of what's happening now. But yeah, what's being done is so unprecedented and global in nature. So Japan's been doing stuff for 20 years. But let's be fair, what they used to do was kind of what Greenspan did in 99. You know, it's a pittance to what they're doing now. So yep. What they're doing now is just really, really huge. And the other thing, their central bank is allowed to buy REITs.
Yeah, how do you like that? That's great, isn't it?
They're allowed to buy ETFs.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're targeting, they really are targeting. And I want to go back to one more point before you go on. We're talking about, the Fed is using a very blunt instrument to help the economy. You know, there's one major point now we've had in the United States since really the Reagan era. It's called the wealth effect, the trickle-down, you know, economics, Reaganomics, if you want to call it in a way. And that's how fiscal policy has been running. And by fiscal policy, you know, what Washington, D.C. has been doing. What Bernanke's Fed is basically says, you know, we're targeting the stock market. You know, Greenspan never used to say that. He'd say, you know, we're monitoring, you know, or I'm kind of, he's kind of do, kind of had a see no evil or see or hear no evil, see no evil kind of viewpoint to the market. I'm sure he was looking at it, but he wouldn't admit it. Whereas Bernanke is literally saying, you know, we are targeting, and his minions throughout all the central bank, you know, governorships and that sort of thing, they have all stated, we are monitoring asset prices. So we know that we're doing something that's affecting the stock market. So when you say it's not doing anything for the economy, you know, my second point is, other than, you know, housing, which has effect, is, you know, and do you believe in the wealth effect, that if the uber rich get a lot of money, that they're going to spend it, and it's going to trickle down to everybody else in the economy. Now, I think that's been refuted in many ways, just from the way that our economy has been structured over the past 20, 30 years. You see the bottom 80% have really fallen behind, and the upper 20% have done pretty darn well. So this same policy is reinforcing that to the nth degree. So, you know, in a way, feel for them, because there's not much they can do. You know, they have to fight, quote-unquote, you know, their two mandates. Fight inflation, and since there is an inflation that the government reports, you know, let's exclude health care, let's exclude college tuition, let's exclude food, let's exclude gasoline, but if you exclude all those things, you know, there's no inflation in their world, and so they literally can do this until inflation is an issue or unemployment gets to a point where they feel comfortable.
Let me tell you something. I love the days when Greenspan would give his testimony. Because it was so
nobody knew what the hell he was saying.
Oh, but it was so great. Come on, it was so great. It was so cryptic.
Obfuscation, right? Obfuscation.
But it was so cryptic.
That's perfect.
And you would listen to him, and you'd honestly, you'd listen and you'd listen and you after you finish, you say to yourself, and anybody that was around you,
what did he say?
What exactly did he just say? Because I, most of the words were well above my level. I'll be honest with you. Okay,
the word syllables or five syllables.
They were enormous, yeah. And then he would say things that seemed to contradict the other to a point that it's almost like an equation of
But that was all on purpose.
One
right?
equals one. You're like.
That was on purpose.
Yeah,
he did that on purpose.
It was brilliant. It was brilliant. And he did it. I'm sure he was smiling the whole time, going back and having a scotch and a cigar afterwards, laughing his ass off. But when it comes to this, I think that there is my concern has been Japan. I have been very vocal about this. I think what they have done by unleashing this amount of stimulus and the way they've done it by giving the green light and the G20, which has said pretty much, we don't want to have currency wars and we don't want to have any kind of, competitive devaluations, but it's, and they don't even mention anything that Japan's doing here, even though there's a lot of murmurs about this. South Korea is pissed off as hell because they're getting killed.
You're talking about all the Central America, there's countries that don't need to be cutting rates that are doing that because of their, South Korea is the example I was going to even bring up to you. As I know, they're a major exporter, all the Samsung, all the auto companies. So they don't necessarily need to cut rates right now, but when, Japan is, they're a major exporter as well. Not everybody can be an exporter. Not everybody can have their currency at the bottom at the same time. It's all relative. Currency is a relative game. Like our currency is kind of going up. Nobody's caring right now. We have major exporters. It matters to us, but nobody cares about earnings reports right now. It's like, well, it's the Fed's making the market go up. Who cares? But South Korea, and it depends what they're doing. I felt, it's funny. Their currency went up for about 3 hours the day they cut the rates, and then it fell for 3 hours, and then immediately just shot back up.
Yeah, but the difference is that. The big issue there is obviously it's like going to two stores that are side by side with each other selling essentially the same products, and one has them on sale for 20% less because of the currency move. But the other thing that's really fascinating is as we see the yen move, it is directly correlated to the Japanese markets. Now, we saw a 7% move down the other day in the Nikkei. We saw the Mother's Index, which is about 120% since they started all this, down, something like 20-something percent. We saw another 3%, another 3% move.
5%.
Now, what's really interesting is, in my opinion, if currencies are so much, so important for the Japanese, and they do a lot of exporting, and we do exporting as well, and we're competitive, as our currency is moving up, first of all, we saw some things happen with gold that was wonky. Oil did not drop to speak for anything. And our exporters, Cat and a few others that were directly competitive to Japanese products have not done well. But generally speaking, our markets are okay. And usually the mode has been that when our dollar moves higher, it is not as good for the overall economy and it's not good for the markets. But again, as you say, nobody cares about
that. Nothing matters. Yeah. Well, a lot of those relationships do. Is a strong dollar good for markets? When you say usually, it depends what time frame you are. I mean, there were times in the 80s and 90s where it was fine. The dollar went up with the market. Now we're talking the more recently. It's not necessarily been it's kind of been an inverse relationship. The same thing with bonds. Bond yields have risen. Really, last Wednesday or a week ago Wednesday when Bernanke testified, he had a very dovish, prepared remarks, the speech, and then there was a Q&A that came out, and that was one where he said, "Well, maybe sometime in the next few meetings, if data, is going our way, we might go to tapering." Or he didn't use the word tapering. They don't use the word tapering. We use the word tapering, plateauing, which should be. But there might be a change in our monetary policy. There's been a lot of things that have changed. A lot of high yielding stocks like REITs and utilities just have been pullbacks. Because those have been bond equivalents. People have been hiding into those because you can't get any yield in the bond market. So a lot of these relationships, and bonds have been rallying, bonds have been falling, yields have been rallying, which, again, in the old days, or it depends which old days you're looking at. Sometimes that's bad, sometimes it's good. To a point, it's good, but it gets bad when, again, we're so low right now that they can rally for...
What you have is called a skew. A skew is where you see the change in the bond over a period of time, and that will change the valuation of bonds, number one. Number two, the bigger issue is who's holding the bonds. Right now, there are institutions and there are individuals, but like here... Right, exactly. You got the government on the hook for a massive amount of bonds. They'll, of course, spin it that they made money on it somehow, but they're on the hook for this, and that's what's happening in Japan. When you go from a half a percent to 1%, and they're holding the majority of the bonds over there, and the potential for them to having to pay out much more in
overall. They have a much higher debt load.
Big problem. They're 260% to GDP. We're only about 65% to GDP. Let me get into some of the posts that you wrote this week, because I thought they were kind of interesting. Last week, like a couple of weeks. You mentioned things like not so quite as ugly as last Wednesday. Tuesdays with Benjamin, it kind of caught me. You know, this whole idea that
it's amazing.
On Tuesdays, for some ungodly reason, that we've seen 20 Tuesdays in a row that were up. And I started thinking about this. I'm like, what is it on Tuesdays? What is it?
I have no idea.
Well,
I know.
I'm not telling you, though.
Okay, here we go.
Yeah, I'm not telling you.
Not going to disclose it. Okay, you can tell it.
Well, a couple of things. I was thinking first. I said, you know, let me think. Maybe there's little economic data. Maybe. I'm thinking to myself, right? I'm thinking, maybe you don't have anything like the weird weekend stuff that comes out from China. You know, they get the weekend eco numbers that come out and all that. And maybe in the U.S. there's not as much eco numbers. And I started looking through it. I'm like, well, I can't really point to that necessarily, you know, because sometimes there are and sometimes there aren't. We're talking about 19 weeks before this week that, you know, we saw it, and this week made it 20.
The strange thing with that, I'll let you continue, is there's been a couple of weeks where there's not been a Monday open for trading. And if your theory is, look, the first day of the week, you come back, there's some reaction to those, you know, Chinese reports or whatever, that would happen on a Monday. But I think there's been President's Day, and then we had Memorial Day, and there might have been one more in there, or MLK Day. I think there's been three, either two or three. I'm not sure President's Day was on Monday. I don't recall off the top of my head. But so we've had days where Tuesday was the first day of the week, and they still were up. I don't know about your theory on that.
Before this week, I wrote before this week even happened, I wrote the reasons why Tuesday could be up. And I kind of just tried to speculate what were the reasons. Number one, I said, because Tuesdays are up. That's the first reason. The second reason is it's the last week of the month, and therefore you have some window dressing going on potentially. And it happens quite often in the last week on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. The third thing is that we had housing numbers coming out, and generally speaking, housing numbers have been better, and the probability of housing numbers either coming in or beating were high. And finally, there was the fact that we saw a consumer confidence number, and if you kind of look at the University of Michigan that came out, it was much better than was expected. The probability
University of Michigan is always the one to stick to, just so you know.
No, I understand that. Although they've been a little bit strange lately with their weird revisions. Those revisions have been way out of range.
Watch your mouth about the University of Michigan.
All right, Mr. Go Blue. I got some Michigan in my family as well. So
all right.
I understand that. But you know what I'm saying?
I don't think there's any explanation. I think it's a random. It's just a random.
It's a quirk.
But what's strange about it? And you know as I know, anything that everybody knows in the market stops working. So I was talking about this about 11 or 12 weeks, you know, when it was 11 or 12 weeks in a row, but it wasn't very, you know, very talked about. About 4 to 5 weeks ago, you started seeing it when it was around 15 or 14 or 16, you started seeing it everywhere. And when everybody knows something on Wall Street, it usually fails immediately. I mean, or it does it one more week and then it's done. So the strange thing is now that everybody's aware of it and it's still happening. The record is 24, just so you know, 24 Wednesdays.
Oh, great.
Sometime in
June.
I don't know what year it was, you know, the 30s or 40s, you know, sometime, you know, maybe 50s or whatever it might have been. So there's a record to break. And if Bernanke wants to break a record, he's going to break a record.
It's great. You can go down as the guy with the longest Tuesdays in a row up in the markets.
It's completely random. Yeah. But what's amazing about it is all the gains have been that day, which is what that post was about. There's been no gains net of all the other 4 days combined. Literally, you know, I joke about it, you know, on Twitter or whatever. You know, there's going to be hedge funds launching, you know, Tuesdays only partners.
Nice.
You know, be open, go in the market 3:55 Monday p.m. and leave 4 o'clock Tuesday.
That's it.
Through Tuesday and take a 6 day week.
It's a beautiful thing. Beautiful thing. Let's talk about, you know, when we talk about the movement and the consecutive numbers of Tuesday, let's say, for example. You know, it's pretty amazing that we see the rally continue. And one of the big things that has been talked about for years has been the lack of participation with the retail. Now, one of the things that we're seeing is that there's some talk that balance funds are receiving just an inordinate amount of new money in, which kind of explains the 9:30 move on the markets where, you know, your futures are down or wherever they are. But 9:30 comes and, you know, any experienced trader knows you don't buy in the open. Don't do it, okay? But yet what we're seeing is a dramatic rise, almost, you know, even when the markets are down 20 points on the S&P pre-open, this gigantic move of buying on the tick of the open. And that's kind of fascinating. And I think
isn't our purchase orders from our Fed also generally not 9:30 to 10, but generally I think somewhere between 10 and 11.
Right, but what I'm saying is it's 9. You've seen it. It just pops at 9:30. But I think that more so the big question is, are retail clients getting a little bit more involved at this point? And, whether or not they are or aren't, the fact of the matter is that there is obviously a bid. And bid can also come from the fact there's a lot of selling of currencies and, kind of hedging, margining that up, if you will. And then buying some.
Well, the other thing is stock buybacks is the other one. And yeah. I don't have data in front of me. That I can quote for you, unfortunately, but they were stock buybacks in 2006, 2007. I did a lot of analysis when I first started blogging on my old website, I started in mid 2007, and stock buybacks were just an enormous part of the market because even at that point, we weren't seeing a lot of that was again a similar market in 2006, 2007, first half 2007, where it was generally. 2005 as well, 2005 to 2007, mid-2007, the market was generally going up, slicing upward, and we weren't getting a ton of earnings growth, but there were just massive amounts of stock buybacks. And now, again, speaking what's good for the economy versus what's good for the stock market, you see every day, every week, we're seeing companies issuing debt to buy stock because the cost of capital is ridiculously cheap.
Right.
And these are the dislocations we're talking about. It's not just that you can say is good or bad, but you saw junk bond yields drop below 5% for the first time ever. You're starting to see some strange mortgages, more exotic mortgages or financing, without getting too far in the weeds. That is way levered, less conservative than we've had. And did we go too far in 2009 or 2008 to the point of conservatism? Probably. But as you get later in the cycle, you start seeing stupid deals, and bad companies receiving, they're saying, we're talking about Japan going to the, again, this is not just the United States. We're talking about a global liquidity tsunami, and people are talking about, and I don't know, there's no price discovery out there because we don't know what real prices are. We're talking about, a good example is Italian and Spanish debt. Their thresholds, they've dropped to the lowest levels in years now, and those are considered, longer 10-year or 30-year debt in those two countries are considered kind of the proxy of if the Eurozone is healthy or not healthy, and they've dropped dramatically. But if you're a Japanese investor and your cost of funding is, minuscule, and you can go out and get 4% in a quote-unquote, I don't want to say risk-free because it's not backed by the ECB the same way the United States is or Japan is because they have a different structure over there, but If you can get that spread of 3 or 3.5%, and you're in a country that we're 0.5%, they're pretty darn good. That's very attractive. So are things improving in the Eurozone as the bond market is telling us, or are we kind of getting stupid moves because there's just so much money chasing so few assets? And it all comes down to supply and demand at the end of the day. If you have X amount of German bonds, you have X amount of Japanese bonds, X amount of U.S. bonds, and Brazilian and Spanish and Italian, but you introduced, global currency chasing those same fixed amount of assets, relatively fixed, prices have to go down just by nature of mathematics. So, a lot of people are saying, well, things are healthier in Europe because just look at the bond yields. I don't know that.
No, we know
who knows what's going on?
We know for a fact that when they announced when the actual announcement came out, I think it was April, in Japan, about the stimulus and all that, that is exactly when a massive amount of bond buying went on in the peripheral region of Europe, and it was not because of structural reforms or better banks. As a matter of fact, we're seeing that there was a restructure a couple of days ago.
There's pushback on all the restructures. Nobody wants to do austerity. Nobody wants to do austerity because it's not fun.
Yeah.
So it's all being pushed back.
Exactly.
And, you have ECB or you have Draghi basically at the European Central Bank saying, I'm here, whatever it takes. And then you have all this central banks. So it's kind of a whole new world. I mean, we are just living in a grand experiment. I think that's the main thing for listeners to understand. And, none of us have a playbook for this because, again, the only thing modestly similar again, you pointed to Japan, where Japan's been doing for 20 years. They didn't do anything of this scope. And in the United States, we haven't done anything of this scope. Everything we've done has been a fraction of what we've done now. And there have been crazy effects. Like, you know, we saw NASDAQ 1999, and you saw the fallout from that. So what if you are kind of a hard money person or a person that thinks what's being done is kind of crazy, or, you know, basically, or we have been in an we're in an emergency stance. Let's put it this way. The central banks of the world are in an emergency stance in a world that's not in an emergency right now.
Right.
Now, you can always use the counterfactuals, like if they're not there, if they weren't doing what they're doing, maybe we would be back into emergency. Nobody can argue that or not argue that. Nobody knows what's going to happen. But we're doing irregular policy in, you know, a typical, you know, we're in a 1.5-2% type of GDP world. Europe's been where Europe's been, and Japan's been the same place it's been for years. Is this the type of environment you should be doing those type of policies? And that's the big argument. And there's always going to be the other side of the slope, and that's kind of where you and I and other people who are doubters, or we're going to eventually be correct about it. You know, we're way too early to worry about it. You know,
yep.
People worry. You know, Greenspan made a very famous speech where he used the word irrational exuberance. It's now, you know, famous. Everybody's folklore in Wall Street.
Good
that
book.
Was in 1996.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So that continued on, and he stoked it. This is the funny thing about central bankers. He said that, and look what he did, like we just talked about, what he did in 1998 and what he did in 1999 to avoid any pain. And what I think what central banks have done is, you know, the firefighter example, and I probably have used mm-hmm. on your program in the past. Mm-hmm. We do not allow brush fires anymore. So if you ask any firefighter, they want brush fires to happen, localized brush fires, so that there is not dry kindle, so that when there's the big one, it all, you know, all that kindling is ready to explode.
Mm-hmm.
So the Federal Reserve and under other banks, they don't want to have even mini recessions anymore. You know, that was a great, the great moderation was what Greenspan had invented, quote unquote. And we saw the great moderation was crap. It was basically he kicked every can there was until he left, and then we saw what the great moderation. you don't allow things to go, you know, the market to clear for 12 years. You have what happened, you know, and again, there was a lot of factors. There was the housing, there was the, you know, CDS, there was all these, or CDOs, there were all these crazy things on banks' balance sheet. But, you know, we're going to do the same thing. And the irony is when this all explodes again and comes in, the Fed's going to come in on the white knight, as the white knight, and say, hey, we're here to fix it.
Well, first
and
the Congress.
And we say to them, you're the one who caused it,
yeah,
guy.
First the Congress comes in. Then that. Let me just skip totally, and we need to end in a second. But
yep.
I know that you manage a mutual fund, and there's issues about, you know, talking about individual stocks. I don't know if you could tell me about maybe sectors or stock that you think is your favorite short, or something that looking interesting, or maybe even just throw some names out
there. Let's talk about what's, you know, changed recently. Like we talked about since last Wednesday, you know, since February, you know, this year kind of has been a strange market in the fact that at the turn of the year, every year the past 3 years, we've had that end of the year rally or beginning of the year rally, you know, basically starts in December. We kind of do the December effect kind of early. People try to front run that. That's where kind of small caps rally ahead of the turn of the year. For whatever reason, that seems to work, and people start doing that second week of December now. So you kind of have that rally from the second week of December through the end of January. We've had, and that's been very aggressive cyclical type of stocks. That's been, you know, if you think about names that anybody would know, the Caterpillars, the Deers, Harley-Davidson, you know, those type of stocks.
Mm-hmm.
That happened again this year, you know, basically. And that's, you know, that idea behind that is China is going to rebound. You know, that's been the thesis of the past 3 years. China is going to restart. You know, the world's economic engine is going to be restarting, and we're all going to, you know, benefit. And then by sometime around February or March of every year, the economic data starts softening, and that trade goes away. And then you kind of have a correction in other years. Now, this year, we didn't really have a correction. What happened is all that money that was doing the cyclical trade in for the first 8 weeks of this rally moved to defensives around early February, mid-February. And that rally lasted for about 2 months straight. And that was, the three sectors are utilities, consumer, non-discretionary, which are, you know, toilet paper, baby, you know, Pampers, you know, those type of Colgate, those type of companies. And what's the third one? I'll tell you, consumer staples, utility, healthcare would be the third one. Not the biotech necessarily, but kind of just healthcare, the Johnson & Johnson. So that's where all the money was going, and P multiples on those stocks, those quote-unquote safe sectors. You know, you had a lot of low 20 PEs on companies that grow 4 to 6% a year. So if you're what's called a GARP investor, which is growth at a reasonable price, or you do, you know, PE to growth ratios, it was way out of whack. So these safe companies became very unsafe, if you want to put it, because their valuations became ridiculous. You want to pay high premiums for companies that are growing, in theory. You know, if a company's growing 30%, you know, you're willing to give it a good PE of a 30 to 45 or whatever you might do it. You don't give that to Coca-Cola. But that's what the kind of, we were getting some crazy, crazy moves, because people want to stay involved with the markets. It's the David Tepper rally. Stay involved with the market. But I don't want, all the cyclical trades aren't working. Mm-hmm. Commodities haven't been working all year. So I need to stay involved in the market. Now, that lasted to around the end of April, and we've seen another rotation. So back to the cyclical trade. Now, in other years, what we've seen the past 2010, 2011, 2012, we'd have a bona fide correction where all these things would kind of go down together, and we kind of have a reset. That hasn't happened this year. That's been the difference in this year, why we haven't had a correction. There's been an amazing rotation. You have to give bulls credit. There's always something working in this market. When some things fall off, something else takes its place. Now, since last Wednesday, there's been just dramatic drops in what we talked about, those bond equivalents. The utilities have dropped just amazingly quickly. Mm-hmm. The reset dropped. Yeah. All those consumer staples that are safe, you know, I saw yesterday Kimberly-Clark dropped 4% earlier this week. So that's kind of a big drop when you're, you know, you buy a Kimberly-Clark for a 3% yield or 2% yield and you lose it all in one day. So, you know, where are we going to be? You know, what do you like or what you don't like? You have to take this for week by week and month by month where the money is going. Right now, semiconductors have picking up the pace. Financials have been the all-star.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to hate the market. You know, there's a lot of divergences happening, which you know and I know. We've been talking about divergences incorrectly to a degree because they haven't mattered. Price only is the only thing that matters at the end. They will eventually matter, but they don't matter until they do matter. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, sure.
There's still divergences happening right now, but a market led by financials specifically and then other kind of cyclical companies, it's kind of hard to say it's going to fall apart. You know, can there be a 5% correction? Sure. Can there be a 10% correction? Can there be a crash when these are the leaders? It's difficult to say that.
Yeah, but at the same time, we're seeing copper fall off and manufacturing really slow down. It is a very bifurcated situation.
That's the funny thing. Yeah, you're talking about economics, though, right?
Has
the economics mattered to the market?
No. Data doesn't matter.
That's the thing.
I hear you.
That's when you leave out.
I hear
you. The thing I want to point out to you, last thing before you go, is what's happened this year? And, you know, why is the market going up? There's two components to, you know, we talk about a P.E. ratio. There's two components to a P.E. ratio. There's price. There's the earnings, and then there's the multiple on that earnings. So we've seen, you know, I'm sure many of your guys have talked about that. We've seen, you know, very slow growth on earnings this year. And it's all the way back to last second quarter or third quarter of 2012. Earnings have grown very, very slowly, and a lot of it is cost-cutting, which has been the story for years. And then the other thing is share buybacks. You're seeing earnings per share go up because there's less shares in the market.
Right.
But so earnings are kind of stagnated. Now, that they're going down, but they're going up 3% or 4% year over year. But what's expanded has been the multiple, and that's what makes it a difficult market. If you're buying a market because earnings are going up, that's a little easier to grasp. Multiple is totally
subjective. Of course, it's whatever.
It could be 17. It could be 14. It could be 13. It could be 12. It could be 16. And going back to the bond yields rising, you know, what's the main reason people have said the PE multiple should be higher than it otherwise would be is because yields are so low on our treasuries.
Right.
Now, what's been happening the last week and a half? Yields have risen. You know, we've breached the 2%, 2.1% on the 10-year. So the argument for the bulls, if this continues...
Well, they'll find something else. They'll find something else to say.
Well, they will. But this is the argument that you have to buy stock because there's no alternative and yields are so low.
Right.
Therefore, the multiple should be higher. That one starts getting hurt.
No, but you come in with is that the economy is getting better, and that's why interest rates are going back. It's fine. I mean,
always a reason.
There's always a reason, which is which is fine, by the way. And you know what? But still, I think stock by stock is the best way to go. We need to end it here. This has been a great conversation. Mark Hanna, who is the manager of the Paladin Long Short Fund. You can find him over at marketmontage.com or just look up the symbol PALFX. I appreciate your time, buddy.
Thanks a lot, Andrew.
All right, bye-bye. You know what's nice about Mark? I don't have to really pull things out of him. I don't have to really, you know, I can just wind him up a little bit and he goes. And I really like that because a lot of times you have guests on that, you know, give you very short answers or give you very shallow information and you know who they are. But most of the time when I talk with Mark, all I have to do is bring up a topic and off he goes. That's really awesome. I appreciate that. And he also has some great writings on his website, which I think that you should check out. Make sure to make it a regular stop. One of the ways that I like to find information, by the way, and a lot of times people ask me, where do I look for news and alerts and things like that? You know, I have so many different services that are flashing at all times. But when I just want to check it out quickly and on the run, or maybe I'm doing something mobile, I go to a place called FinViz, not a commercial for them, by the way, finviz.com. Now, this, when you go there, the main page is all about stocks and futures and, you know, most up, most down. But click on the news heading there, right to the top left, the second one over. And you'll find that on the left-hand side is a grouping of, I guess we'd call that mainstream media. You know, you have Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, and MarketWatch, and Yahoo Finance, and all this stuff. On the right-hand side are all bloggers. And actually, our blogs show up there. Market Montage, Mark shows up there. You have Ritholtz, The Big Picture, and you have the gang over from Mish is also there. It's about probably Zero Hedge is there. Probably about 25 or 30 different bloggers that come out. And as soon as the information is posted, they just pull it right over and you can check it out. So I just thought I'd mention that. There's also a really good screener on that site, probably one of the best ones I know about, and some other goodies. I got to go back and check out some of that because I don't look at it as often as I should because they always come up with something new. But anyway, I like them. Let's talk about some of the eco that I think that's important to discuss here. And not a lot of earnings, by the way, coming out. There's a few things. But in terms of eco, very important. On Sunday night, right after you listen to this for the first time, if you got it on Sunday, then you're going to know that we're going to be seeing the economic numbers, some more economic numbers from China. Now, in China, what we saw was that over the weekend, there was actually a point that was out that showed the manufacturing, the PMI, they call it, and that was a little bit better than expected. Actually, it was above the high end of even the highest estimate by about 0.1. But the big question was whether or not China was going to be slowly slipping into a contraction area for that. Now, we're going to have the non-manufacturing number at 9 p.m., expectations for about 54, 55. They've been pretty strong in that area, the service area. And then we have the HSBC, which is the PMI, another alternative number that looks at the manufacturing, not just the government sponsored or the government issued numbers. And they're looking for about a 49.6. Now, if in fact we do still see that in the sub 50 area, that will mean that there is continued contraction within the manufacturing. And for the most part, a lot of people rely on that rather than the government statistics. Because, you know, we've seen a lot of question lately about what's going on with the government statistics and whether or not there's some weird things with imports, exports, etc. So I think it's interesting. Now, I have a lot of news here. Let's see. Well, let's continue with economics first. We have the ISM manufacturing, very important number coming out at 10 o'clock on Monday. Expectations are for about 50.7. Now, again, the only number that I saw was last week's Chicago PMI that was really anything that I could even say was reasonable. But the rest of them, between the Philly Fed and the various regional manufacturing numbers that have been put out, have been pretty awful. Now, if we stay above 50, I think it would be pretty great, and it's very possible, but at the same time, I just wonder if that's going to be the case. The prices paid number probably will continue to move down before this month. Previously, it was 50. It's about 49.5, and that really talks about how much is the cost of items going into the manufacturing process, kind of like a PPI. We're going to see total vehicle sales also in the evening on the 3rd. We're looking for about a 15 million run rate for the year in total. Now, a couple other things that we want to look at that's important. ADP will be coming out with their employment numbers on Wednesday. 165,000 is the survey. Last time was about 119,000. They've been a little bit wider ranging recently. They've been oftentimes a very good look through to the Friday numbers, but they've kind of gotten a little bit off. We're going to see non-farm productivity. It looks like it's flat month-to-month, of up about 0.7. Unit labor costs up also. Factory orders are expected to move to a plus 1.5% month-over-month versus last month, where they were down negative 4%. I would again expect the manufacturing numbers and the factory orders to come in a little bit light. The ISM non-manufacturing, the service index, which oftentimes correlates pretty well to the confidence numbers, and confidence numbers for the University of Michigan and from the conference board were up nicely over the last week or so. And we're looking at about a 53.5, which is an increase slightly over last month. Of course, we have the Fed Beige Book coming out also on the 5th, and then we have initial claims, et cetera. But on Friday, we're going to be having the change in the private and the change in the manufacturing payrolls. And we're looking for not much of a change. Actually, change in total, I think I misspoke before, change in non-farm payrolls are looking to be 165,000. Keep that number in your head. And the unemployment rate at 7.5%. The average hourly earnings, and when we look at that on a month-to-month basis, looking to stay flat. Now, we did see last week that earnings stayed flat, but spending was down. Now, of course, you're seeing a lot of the news saying, oh, it was a blip. Well, I don't know. You have consumer confidence up. I'm not sure why that's a blip right now, especially with a strong dollar. You know, I'm not really sure where that's coming into play, that we have a blip versus the reality that there's a little bit of savings going on and people are a little bit concerned with the market. And, of course, we'll see the underemployment rate, the U6 number, which is currently at about 13 or 13.5%. Some quick news items really quickly. I know we're running a little bit long, but I'll get to the heart of some of this. I'm not going to read this ridiculousness from Japan where they said that, they say that stocks are okay, that they fall because they're adjusting or whatever crap that is. Let's see. We saw the S&P slipped about 1.1% for the week, and the hardest hit were utilities and interest rate stocks. We know that. There is something that we're going to talk about this week on DH Unplugged, which is going to be the whole idea of what is this whole new respiratory syndrome coronavirus, which recently came and was discovered in Italy, mostly cases seen in the Middle East. And this gentleman did travel to Jordan, but we'll look at that. Jean Stapleton died. I'll talked about, she was a member of Edith Bunker. Archie. And her nickname was Dingbat. Remember that? She died. She was one of the stars of the 1970s television show All in the Family. And I'm kind of wondering whether or not that would be tolerated in this politically correct world that we have right now. Some of the things we'll talk about on DH Unplugged this year as this week as well. Coming up, you'll see it on Wednesday at the earliest or the latest, I should say. So wrapping this all up, we have rates that are going up. We have this reverse Tepper situation that may happen on Friday. I'm really looking forward to finding out what that's all about and how that's going to work. And we'll see what happens with markets right now. But I will tell you that there was a pretty substantial sell-off on Friday, and it was on very high volume. Keep a look at that. Keep a watch on that. And let's be very careful out there right now, because there's an adjustment happening in the markets to this whole new rate environment, to the higher level of higher price of the dollar, and obviously the adjustment of the yen and whatever's happening there. We'll see how that may pop back or not, when the fact is that we saw at least one reading from China that was better so far on the week. Otherwise than that, let's see. What else do we have to talk about? I guess that's pretty much it. If you have any questions, write me, askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll mention also that Trigger Point Research, the equity portfolio, is doing pretty well, still up about 11.5% year over year. And that's very nicely seeing a slope from bottom left to top right. And our recent moves into some of the short and long positions have been paying off very, very nicely. So if you haven't gotten your 14-day free trial and checked it out, or even if you did, you got to make sure to subscribe to it. And we're also putting out weekly videos, so make sure to check out all the things that are happening over at TriggerPointResearch.com. Make sure to be on my Twitter feed, because we'll put a lot of that out there, at Andrew Horowitz. One word, at Andrew Horowitz. Thanks a lot for joining me. Thanks a lot for listening. Thanks a lot for being there. Don't forget to send out a reminder to friends that they should listen in as well. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.